Last week has been one of the bloodiest in the history of domestic conflict in Tajikistan since civil war of early 90s. There are numerous versions on what really happened in the Tajik capital, in which dozens of people killed and wounded in two separate attacks. As we speak, events continue to develop as a large-scale military operation is underway to hunt the alleged perpetrator of the attack. Also, questions are being raised about the event, the motive, its extension and circumstances in which those events have reportedly taken place. In this week's Majlis, we aim to look into various versions, motivations, and its background. Hello, welcome to the Majlis. I am Mohammed Tahir, Director of the Turkmen Service at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. To discuss the subject, I have Parviz Mullajanov, an independent analyst based in Dushanbe, Dr. John Hidershaw, Associate Professor of International Studies at the University of Exeter, also author of the recent book called Transformation of Tajikistan. From the same university, Edward Lemon is joining us, who closely follows developments in Tajikistan. My colleague Bruce Panier, who runs the Kishlak Awazi, the Central Asia blog at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, is also joining me in the studio here. So thank you very much, gentlemen, for participating in the show. Let's get rolling the event that is currently developing in Tajikistan. Now, there are more questions than answers at this stage as we speak on what really happened in Dushanbe last week. Mr. Mullajanov, probably you are the best person to educate us in this subject. How things looks like at the moment today in Dushanbe concerning those events that took place last week?
You have rightly said right now that there are more questions than answers, and this is purely true, the truth of Tajikistan today, because we have several versions of the events and they are contradicting each other, and the information also contradicting each other, and the figures are different. So actually there are not too many reliable information to speculate on. So far we can say that there are actually several versions, three versions actually.
Right.
So the first version is stated by the Tajik government. This is the official version, according to which the revolt is defined as a coup d'etat related to the Islamic Renaissance Party of Tajikistan. At the same time, the Tajik version is not unified. The official version is not unified as well, because there are different subversions proposed by various government agencies. So each subversion states different numbers of victims, arrested fighters, and causes of the events, etc., etc. There is also the version which was recently, just a couple of days before, was proposed by the Tajik general Nazarzadeh, who is considered head of the revolt. So according to his version, the uprising was provoked by the Tajik official agencies themselves. According to this version, the Tajik government was planning to arrest a group of former UTO, United Tajik Opposition Field Commanders, and fighters, and was planned to accuse them in attacking several police stations. However, according to the general, prior to the government operation, the former field commanders received information, they were warned, and therefore they were forced to take the arms against the government. According to this version, they were actually forced to start the uprising. And there is the third version. The General Nazarzadeh was supposed to be prosecuted by the Tajik government, and he received also information that the prosecution is going to start soon, and therefore he started the uprising.
Mr. Mullajanov, you explained briefly various versions behind these developments. What version looks like more likely from your point of view?
I think that the truth is somewhere in between. I mean, I'm not supporting any of the versions fully, but I support that the Tajik general version is explaining a lot, much more than the version proposed by the government. At the same time, there are also weak sides of this version as well. For instance, the Tajik general stated that the government was going to prosecute him and his supporters because they didn't sign the letter against the IRPT, Islamic Renaissance Party of Tajikistan.
Right.
And they refused to support the government plans on closing the Islamic Renaissance Party. But this it sounds groundless, because just 1 year or 2 years ago there was such a letter, and it was signed by the general.
Right. John, I think you also have one version. I just was reading your blog on that subject you put out, I believe, yesterday or before yesterday. Do you think that it's a continuation of similar events?
Yes. I mean, of the three versions Parviz outlined, I think that the third version of the fact that Nazar Zadar had prior warning of a move against him is the most convincing, given what happened. If it was a coup d'etat, it was an extremely ineffective one, with very few people involved in support of his actions. So it doesn't look like that kind of action at all. Equally, if it was just provocatia in the way that Nazar Zadar is trying to, or people around him, supporters of him, are trying to represent, then I think it's hard to explain quite why he was motivated to such extreme action. So it looks like an attempt to move a person within government, within the security services, out, and then it looks consistent with struggles within the state that have taken place, particularly those that have taken place some time after the war. So I'm thinking of Mirza Khujar Akhmadov in 2008, Mirza Ziyev 2009, even more junior people like Davlatov 2010-11 in Rasht, and the struggles in 2012 in Khorog, where you have struggling between security services personnel. So this is very much an intrastate conflict, rather than a rebellion against the state, rather than a rebellion against the government or a coup d'etat. So for me, that's the most convincing explanation. It's more or less consistent with patterns of rebellions that we've seen over the last few years. What is distinct about this is that it's a very senior person who was relatively recently promoted to Deputy Defense Minister, only promoted in January 2014, I think, someone who was still in government, unlike Mirza Ziyev, who had, you know, resigned some years before, and the fact that there was attacks in Dushanbe, which obviously makes it a lot more serious than if the violence is just in the regions. So it's a more acute case, but it looks quite consistent with other outbreaks of violence that we've seen.
Right. Edward, what is your take about what so far being discussed?
Well, I think my kind of take on the situation is very similar to John's. Government posts in Tajikistan don't merely mean serving the public good. They're also an opportunity for elites to accumulate wealth and power. So Nazar Zadar was not only deputy defense minister, he also owned a poultry farm, a bread factory, and a number of economic assets that he managed to accumulate through his government post. So obviously when his position came under threat, and I tend to agree with John that the third narrative that Parviz outlined is maybe the most likely. You know, he decided to defend his position with violence. I think another piece of evidence that points towards that theory is the fact that a large arms cache was captured by the army. And if it was a premeditated attempt at a coup d'etat, then surely he would have, as John said, accumulated. He would have gathered more soldiers around him, more foot soldiers around him, and he would have obviously armed them and not left his main arms cache to be captured. So that kind of points to the idea that this was a spur of the moment moved by him and his supporters. But I agree that it's really the result of intrastate conflicts between elites.
Right. Bruce, you follow Tajikistan for years, as I know you. Was there any indication of something like this building up in Tajikistan recently?
No, as far as it concerns this individual Nazarzadeh, I didn't see anything in the news. I do kind of believe that the timing of this is linked to the closure of the Islamic Renaissance Party of Tajikistan. It seems like they were trying to show that this guy was somehow still connected to the old party, and when they were preparing to close it, this was going to be the exclamation point on the whole thing, was that we're closing them because they're not doing anything within the country, and they also have individuals like this in their ranks who are trying to cause trouble within the country. So the timing, anyway, I think was more than a coincidence that this all came. You know, they were supposed to close the party down on the 7th. Officially, it stopped functioning as a registered party. And on the 4th, all of a sudden, we have these problems and, you know, with Nazarzadeh. And of course, the government right away, the initial reaction was to link him as closely as possible to the Islamic Renaissance Party, when in fact he hadn't really been a member of the party for many years. And even during the Civil War era, his connection to the party was tenuous at best. I mean, he wasn't in the country for most of the Civil War. I would say that was probably the motivation from the government on doing this. Now, that said, of course, he was getting to be a more influential figure in Tajikistan, and our other speakers have alluded to the fact that when you are promoted, you are also allowed to accumulate a certain amount of wealth, a certain amount of influence within a region. Often there's a time when the government feels that these people have exceeded what's permissible from the view of Dushanbe and decide that they need to act against them to rein them in somewhat. But I would think that this was more time to blacken the image one last time of the IRPT.
I also have a hard time to accept the government narrative, actually, that an official comes out, in this case, the deputy defense minister Nazarzadeh comes out with some of his followers, picks up weapons and attack a military post. The guy, allegedly the ringleader, shouldn't be, you know, that naive to attack a military post, whatever intention he might have behind his action. Because simply because he should know that he cannot win this battle. Mullah Janab, how you explain that? Why he did what he did?
According to him, and according to some informal information, he was warned that he will be arrested just one day prior to the operation. And he called several of his subordinates to his house, and then to his office, actually, and they decided, it was just in the middle of the night, and they decided, and then they got information during the meeting that the government forces are already blocking the city. And then they decided to rush in the mountains. And so on the way to the mountains, he decided to take his family because his home was located just along the road to the mountains. But at the same time, just close to his house, there was already a block post of OMON, of militia special forces. And then just around his house, the first main clashes occurred, which caused it actually several lives of police officers and attackers. And he managed to break through and to escape in the and to take refuge in the mountains. So what really happened? And actually, this is an evidence that the whole revolt wasn't properly prepared.
Prepared in advance.
Yeah. Actually, there are a lot of contradicting information, but we can make three main conclusions. So the first conclusion, that this is actually a new crisis in relationship between the Tajik government and former field commanders. They always had a very complicated relationship. And the field commanders, which were included and integrated into the Tajik army, were not trusted by the government. And the government has a policy to eliminate any remnants of former field commanded networks in Tajikistan. So the second conclusion, that it certainly would be related to the RPT by the government. So the government certainly would use this event to relate the revolt to the RPT, and it would be used by the government as a new additional argument to close the Islamic Renaissance Party of Tajikistan. And the third conclusion, we can state now that the uprising obviously wasn't prepared, as I stated before. At least the field commanders didn't expect that the events will take place so soon. Otherwise, they would be able to take their families out of the city or even out of the country beforehand. They would be able to sell their property beforehand. They would be able to stock arms and ammunition in the mountains beforehand. We don't see that. So I think that in addition, they would be able to prepare, I mean, better information propaganda coverage. So they would state some more clear goals and strategy. They would proclaim some clear objectives, etc. They don't have it right now. So my impression is that this was totally unprepared and provoked. I'm not sure by which side. But anyway, I mean, it wasn't prepared.
Yeah, and I'd just like to add on your third point, because I agree, that the level of armed resistance we've seen from these people who are supposedly planning a coup or some action against the government doesn't seem to correspond to the level of threat that the government is describing. Most of these people have surrendered. Since then, we don't hear about armed... We heard about the initial fighting, and since then, we really haven't heard about any fighting going on between these renegade forces and government forces. So as far as the combat is concerned, it died out like very quickly, and most of Nazarzadeh's alleged supporters have just been surrendering.
Yeah, I suppose they don't have a lot of opportunities in the future. I mean, they revolt groups because there is no funds from outside, nobody supporting them from the external stakeholders so far. They don't have enough ammunition in the mountains, they're surrounded. It's not the 90s when the population was going to support them. And the government is much stronger than it used to be before. You know that external support is a key factor for the success of guerrilla war anywhere. Especially in Tajikistan, we don't have right now because this revolt wasn't prepared before.
Yeah, and maybe I just add to that. I think the key question here is whether this is an indicator that things are becoming less stable in Tajikistan or more stable. I'm not really sure the answer to that question. I think it's easy to think that, well, this brings us back to the area of rebellions or threats to the stability of the state,
right,
such as but actually it might be that the state is still able to deal with these things, and that, as you know, as Parviz and Bruce were pointing out, ultimately this is not an effective rebellion, and the signs seem to indicate that it's going to be a very nasty end for Nazarzadeh, and the idea that this might expand or worsen or create further instability at this point looks unlikely.
Here, we will take just a short break, then when we come back, we will be talking about what does really this say about the stability in Tajikistan. So, Mr. Molojanov, you wanted to add something on that subject. So, we have had these similar incidents and accidents or events, as John said earlier, involving Mirzo Hojazada Ahmedov, Mirzo Ziyoyev, Imam Nazarov. Again, we have new incident just took place last week, and it seems to be that despite there is a reconciliation in Tajikistan with the former opposition, the conflict somehow exists. So, what does this say about the stability of Tajik government, Tajikistan, in fact, that it's not going back to the old bad days?
I suppose this is a continuation of the old government policy of eliminating the network of field commanders and getting rid of political opponents. And they believe that it's very important to do that right now because there is ongoing economic crisis, there is impact of Ukrainian-Russian events, war. And there is also a very complicated situation in finances, economic sector in Tajikistan, in the region. And there is also deterioration of the political situation in Afghanistan. So I suppose that the government believes that this is the proper time to get rid of all prospects, all political opponents right now, and all military opponents. Right now in Tajikistan.
If that is the case, that government of Tajikistan is picking up them at this time of point, what we should expect to happen in days to come, in months to come?
Well, I think you're inviting me to talk there. I mean, what's most remarkable here, first of all, is how profoundly post-conflict Tajikistan remains. I mean, this is what we were talking about 10, 12, 15 years ago. We're now almost 20 years after the peace agreement, and still what we find is that a state, which is independent of the independent commanders that composed it, has yet to be built. So the government rhetoric for all this time has been that the state stands above all this, the state is being built, it's becoming strong, and yet it still suffers from these kinds of incidences of political violence. So it's really quite a negative aspect for the state in that respect. And it's sort of rather shocking that we're still in those circumstances. I mean, this is a particularly Tajik thing, yeah? You do not get this in neighbouring states, in Kyrgyzstan or Uzbekistan, where you have political violence there, it's different. This kind of rebellions within the state system is a particular Tajik phenomenon, and it's post-conflict phenomenon. That said, I mean, your wider question of how will this end, I mean, I don't think that necessarily means then that this will spiral out of control and we'll get more and more disorder towards a failed state. Some people have obviously predicted that. But in this case, you know, he has retreated to the mountains. Presumably, we're going to see a situation rather like we saw with Alaveddin Davlatov 4 or 5 years ago, where he is eventually going to be encircled. There'll be a lot of bloodshed. The armed forces of Tajikistan will probably lose a number of personnel because they're not that professional or that well-trained. But nevertheless, they will ultimately wipe out that group. I think it's unlikely in this case, given how high profile it is and how senior a figure he is, that any kind of compromise will take place, such as, for example, took place apparently with Ayan Bekhov and with Mirzakhojar Akhmadov in 2008 after he killed the Oman commander Oleg Zakhachenko. So I don't think we're going to necessarily see a deal to be done. I think we're going to see the wiping out of the group. But, you know, that's prediction, and prediction is a dangerous thing.
But he should not be alone, and Nazarzadeh should not be alone in this case. For example, he should have more of his former allies or the party members still working in the government structure. Will they remain silent, or we should be expecting some sort of action from them? Who wants to take this question? Edward?
I don't think Nazarzadeh has much popular support. You know, he hasn't articulated a clear kind of political vision. So, I agree with John that the likely end scenario here is that he'll be captured or killed. To my knowledge, he was highest-ranking former UTO commander in the government. I'm not sure how many similar characters still exist within the Tajik government at this point, but we are still in the situation, as John said, of a kind of post-conflict state in which these intra-state conflicts are the kind of typical thing that we see. And I think this is interesting because, you know, it's common for outside observers and the government itself to always say that dangers proceed from the outside. The main destabilizing factors in Tajikistan will in fact be external. They will come from, you know, spillovers from Afghanistan. They will come from the Islamic State, which has obviously caused a great deal of concern for the Tajik government. But no, what do we see? Political violence in Tajikistan, if we're thinking of the recent incident in Dushanbe, Khorog, 2012 and 2014, the incidents in the Rasht Valley between 2008 and 2011, these are all about local politics. These are all about the kind of political economy of the post-conflict state. These are all rebellions from within the state itself. Yeah, this obviously runs counter to both the government's discourse and the kind of the dominant discourse from most outside observers.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that this incident points out is that there's still a lot, you know, Nazarzadeh, for instance, was not a particularly well-known figure. When I first saw his name pop up last Friday, he was unfamiliar to me, and I've talked to other people who covered the Tajik civil war, you know, during those years, and they also couldn't remember him. You know, and so it makes me wonder that there's more people like this.
Yeah.
A lot of people gave very, very vague oaths to uphold the peace and allegiance to the government. We know certainly east of Dushanbe, there's a lot of these people who had some influence in certain areas, and apparently the government was willing to go along with them as long as they said that they weren't going to cause trouble. And our speakers have already named incidents that have happened in the 18 years since the peace deal that show that there are these people out there who are not 100% on board with the government. Their loyalty is questionable and suspect to the government, but they've been left alone by the government so that there weren't a lot of internal disputes and we could preserve some sheen of stability within the country. So Nazarzadeh, I look at him as more of an example of probably a dozen or maybe a couple of dozen other people in the country who are in a similar situation. They've been allowed to exist because they didn't cause a lot of problems, but they've always been on a list of people who could, the government feels, cause trouble and therefore at some time or another have to be dealt with. I think that's one of the big problems that Tajikistan faces, is it's not just Nazarzadeh, it's him and a lot of other people that we haven't heard of or haven't heard from recently.
So why he was the target?
Yeah. Why he was the target would have been a specific reason, something that we may never know, that will be very much within the corridors of power for some reason. Obviously, his loyalty was being doubted. I don't think it's directly because he had at some point in the past an association with the Islamic Revival Party of Tajikistan. I think it's more about basic core issues of loyalty and the control of the economy and whether he could be trusted, and maybe he had enemies within the system who decided to target him. So, but ultimately, I'm not sure we'll ever know that. But I'd just like to emphasize, I think Bruce has picked up on a really important point, which is that the dangers of escalation here or further instability are not about a coordinated action which is pre-planned by a group of people, a group of ex-commanders, to launch a coup d'etat, but it's that what another person might feel vulnerable from this, might think it's going to be me next, that these people are capable of anything, they're targeting individual people who were, you know, who came from the Civil War era and now have posts in government, and it might be me now, so that another person might take the opportunity of the instability caused by this incident to then launch their own, you know, minor rebellion or seek to join Nazar Zadar in the mountains. Now, I think if that was going to happen, we would have perhaps seen that already, and it doesn't appear to have happened. Also, it's extremely inaccessible, the Romit Gorge area, so it, in terms of basic geography, it's unlikely that you could have a mustering point for individuals there. But my point is that rather than this being strategically planned, it would come about through a direct result of the insecurity caused by the state's actions against Nazar Sadar. So rather than being the solution to the problem, they're the cause of many of these problems, the initial rebellion of Nazar Sadar, but also perhaps any secondary knock-on effects that might take place.
Mr. Mullojanov, what John pointed out is that there might be fear among the members of former opposition who are still working at the government structure. Is there any fear exist there? What's your feeling, impression?
I think that everything depends on the government now. If the government continues repression on the former opposition fighters, if some of them would be more of them would be arrested, and more of them would feel themselves unsecured, in this case, of course, many of them would go into mountains or would go outside the country and would join the opposition. There is also another factor which should be mentioned, the factor of the RPT, Islamic Renaissance Party of Tajikistan, because if it will be closed, and it will be closed, I believe that 99% that it will be closed soon, we would see a new vacuum appeared in ideological and political appearance in Tajikistan, and this vacuum will be filled by the radical groups and radical Islamist fundamentalist organizations. On the other hand, many of the former RPT members would join the opposition, and would create a social base for such groups as the one now in the mountains. And as to the this general Nazar Sadar group, yes, I mean it doesn't have now enough support on the ground, doesn't have enough funds and ammunition. But if they manage to survive for the next several months, it would in the future there would be a basement, a foundation for the future resistance. And it's very dangerous for the government. Therefore, the government is trying now to eliminate this group as soon as possible.
That's really interesting point. He remain at large at the moment.
The only thing I want to pitch in here too, and I don't want to get off the track, but we've been talking about the former opposition all the time, and I would point out that a lot of people that were allies of the government during the Civil War are also suspect figures. Mayor Ubaidullayev, for instance, it's well known that he was not a good friend with Rahman for very, very many years. Now, I don't know if they reached some kind of rapprochement or if Rahman has managed to get him under his control somehow or another, but that's just one person I can think of who's not an entirely trustworthy ally of Rahman, and there's probably other people in the government like that too. Situations like this with Nazarzadeh just present them with an opportunity, depending on whether they think it's worth the risk or not, to go against the government and side with these people. Nazarzadeh is clearly not powerful enough to oppose the government at this point, but that doesn't mean that there's not somebody else out there who will be more powerful in the future, and you might have a lot of realignment from people who were pro-government allies but are still out there.
Yeah, what's the end game here then?
Yeah, I mean, just to say that's a really important point, which is borne out by academic research. I mean, over the whole period since the mid-90s, it's, you know, research by Jesse Driscoll at University of California, San Diego, actually shows that it's just as likely that a pro-government commander from the war would be pushed out of the system, killed, exiled, arrested as an opposition one. And these categories, pro-government and opposition, you know, they're really quite crude, actually. I mean, these were individuals who were fighting usually for a very small cohort of people around themselves and their families and their core allies. So absolutely, it isn't just those who had some kind of association with the United Tajik Opposition many years ago or the IRPT. It is all individuals who don't feel themselves part of the core elite. And I think the danger in Tajikistan right now is there is a perception, and I think there's some evidence for this, that the core circle is narrowing, that the willingness of the elite in the country, and particularly, you know, those people around the president himself, to share the riches of being in power seems to be diminishing. They somehow have a confidence that they can restrict the number of people that share those benefits of being in power. And I think that's what causes a danger, because with that you get more defections, more rebellions, and the possibility that things could become more unstable. It's a political economy issue there, not one which is about Islamic rebellion or something from outside threatening the country.
Mr. Molojanov, a final note from you?
No, I think that several few weeks we will get more picture, more information about the situation, about the event, and then we would have the clear picture. So far, as I said, we should expect the closure of the RPT in the next several weeks or months. And there is also one factor which also should be mentioned. This is the factor of economic and social crisis that was mentioned also before. And the joining of Eurasian Economic Union, which also an unknown factor, which also would make a negative impact on the socio-economic situation in the country.
Right. Edward?
Well, I think I agree that we are in the last days of the Islamic Renaissance Party. I expect to see its closure in the coming days. I agree that there are still individuals within the government who have the potential to rebel, so I don't think this story is over. I think the interesting thing about this case is, again, the government's kind of knee-jerk reaction to the conflict, stopping SMS services, closing bazaars, blocking a number of websites. And, you know, this has become a real pattern with the government and is only really seeking to kind of alienate young people in particular from the government, create quite a lot of resentment against the regime. So I think that that's a policy that is intended to secure the regime, that in fact may unravel in the long term.
I just wanted to add, last note, I think that this what's happening now has alerted a lot of people in the country who feel that this might happen to them, and that if we do see an incident like this happen again, it'll look a lot more like the Rasht Valley in 2010, 2011 mm-hmm. than it does like Ramat Gorge in 2015.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Bruce Panier, for your insight. And thank you very much, Dr. John Hidershah and Edward Lemon from University of Exeter, and also Pervez Molojanov from Dushanbe, for your insight on this fascinating, interesting subject and interesting development. It has been a fascinating talk today. Thank you very much for your participation in this.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.